Thanks, Andrea. Extension 720 here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200, the phone number if you'd like to chime in. Tonight's theme, walking away. Heard stories about rage quitting in the first hour. And, of course, from our serial entrepreneur, Pete Cadence, who was just in studio, who gave it up and walked away at the age of 40. So we'll continue that theme tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk. We're going to continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods before the election. We're going to be in Chatham talking with Kathy Cheney, where they had a target. Very, very big news story. A target left Cottage Grove just on a whim. So Target walked away from Chatham. They're mad about that. I would be mad about it, too. As Kathy mentions in the interview, imagine if that happened to you in your community. I know it seems frivolous, but for listeners who are out there listening, if it's a big box store, the Target or the Mariano's or the grocery store just packed up and left, and there was no plan to replace it, that would tick you off. So we'll talk with Kathy coming up. And also Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket at Old Town School of Folk Music tonight. We will hear from him and some more live music in studio. My guest tonight in the 8 o'clock hour, quickly becoming, if he isn't already, the most prolific futurist author of our time. Cory Doctorow writes dystopian fiction, I guess is the way to call it that. I'm sure he would say maybe not. But it's not just about post-apocalyptic scribes from a distant and unimaginable time. His stories always deal with technology and our digital world. And like I said earlier, the story could be set 500 years ago, but also tomorrow. It could be any which way. But for all the gloom and doom surrounding how our smart world will enslave us, Doctorow's writing centers around humanity, which ultimately is the only antidote we have. Cory Doctorow's new book is actually four novellas. It's called Radicalized. Doctorow is one of today's best online journalists. He's a co-editor of Boing Boing, and he'll be signing books at C2E2 this weekend at McCormick Place. It's my pleasure to welcome back Cory Doctorow to WGN Radio. Cory, good to see you.
It's lovely to be back. I love your new studio.
It's not. Yeah, it's,
what of you?
It feels like it might be something that you would describe in one of your novels. Yeah, right.
Yeah, maybe just before it falls over.
Just before it falls over. Radicalized. This is four novellas in one. Why did you decide to go this route?
You know, I didn't. These were my Trump derangement syndrome antidotes. I was working on the third Little Brother book, and these stories just kind of battered their way through my fingertips in the interstices between working on the novel. And my agent, my editor, my publisher were all really excited about them and wanted to bring them out and treat them like a novel, which is pretty unheard of for a short story collection. We sold the TV rights to the first of the stories even before the book came out. And
congratulations
the rest
were all, on that. Yeah.
In negotiation. And so they really seem to have hit a chord. It's, we can talk about utopia or dystopia. I think that it's a mistake to assume that just because someone's written a story about things going wrong that they're pessimistic. I think that only an idiot assumes that things will never go wrong. That doesn't make you a pessimist. You know, assuming things will never go wrong is why they never put lifeboats on the Titanic. You know, I think that it's more accurate to say that optimism is the idea that when things go wrong, that we can set them to rights again.
Yeah.
And they're really stories about people taking agency, taking control of the technology in their world, you know, seizing the means of information.
There's two parts to it. Just take the story Unauthorized Bread for the first one. There's two parts. There is that feeling of technology gone amok, smart devices in our homes being classist in a way, being proprietary, making our lives much more difficult when they were designed to be better.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side is humanity and how we overcome that. And you find out in this story that even though there are a lot of things against the main character and against the characters in your book, you know, they do continually solve the problems through human ways.
Yeah, you know, there's this adoption curve for bad technology where when we have a terrible technological idea, we need someone to try it out on who, if they complain, no one will listen. So usually if we have a bad technological idea, first we try it out on refugees and then regular immigrants like me, and then we use it on prisoners and then parolees and then mental patients, kids, blue-collar workers, gig economy workers, and then eventually white-collar workers. So if you want to know what your kids' technological future looks like, look at what we're doing to prisoners. If you want to know what your your technological future looks like, look at what we're doing to kids. And if you want to know what the prisoner's technological future is going to look like, look at how we're treating refugees with technology at any moment. So the protagonist of the story, the refugees, and they've come up against one of our worst technological ideas that's currently in play now, which is designing technology that treats its owner as its enemy and tries to control the owner so that they arrange their lives to benefit shareholders instead of themselves.
It's amazing. And it's not fictional. I mean, I know the book is fictional, but just to give listeners an idea, a toaster that would only toast the bread of the company.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, this is an idea that goes way back to printers and inkjet cartridges. But, you know, when the iPhone came out and they announced that, well, this is only going to run software that comes from the Apple Store, not because it can't run other software, it just will refuse to run other software. For some reason, a lot of people gave them a walk on that. But, you know, that idea, it's metastasized. Johnson & Johnson has regulatory approval for an implanted artificial pancreas with a glucose monitor and an insulin pump. And, you know, insulin's in the public domain. When the discoverers of insulin, Banting and Best, found it, they said, well, we're not going to patent this. It's too important.
Yeah, it's medicine.
But the cartridge is proprietary. And if you refill it, unless you have a code from Johnson & Johnson, it won't recognize the new insulin. And so they can turn human beings with diabetes into kind of walking inkjet printers who have to pay these gigantic premiums just to keep their internal organs working.
And, you know, for every story we see that flirts its way or peeks its head into the mainstream media, I think of the insulin pen, whatever the deal,
EpiPen.
The EpiPen, where it was so expensive it made us all outraged that it was this expensive. There are thousands of stories like that don't reach our devices. We don't hear about it.
Well, and, you know, the interesting thing here is that you have these old laws that have been expanded beyond all reason to cover this stuff. You know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, makes it a felony to bypass a copyright lock. And so every manufacturer from John Deere to Johnson & Johnson to GM has put copyright locks in their devices that you have to bypass if you want to use them to benefit you. It's as though, you know, your car manufacturer had figured out a way to make it a felony to plug a phone charger into your cigarette lighter unless you bought it from them.
That is a big part of the stories that you're telling, especially with unauthorized bread. And it is amazing to me because just talking to Pete today and trying to explain to him, you know, what this story was about, and to hear you talking about real life stories you fictionalize in the book that are real life and happening as we speak, it creates pause.
Well, you know, I think these technological and policy stories, they can be very dry, very abstract. But when you turn them into fiction, they can put a lot of narrative meat on the dry, abstract policy bones and can make people think about it. You know, like if it were 1949 and we were arguing about whether we should use the peace dividend to put cameras everywhere, it would be kind of, I might say, well, my privacy would feel a bit weird about that. But, you know, once 1984 comes out, we can just say, well, that's a rather Orwellian idea, don't you think?
Right.
And that's one of the things I'm trying to get at here. You know, I have another life where I do policy advocacy, but writing about this stuff in fiction and giving a kind of architectural fly-through of what it would be like to live in a world if these policies aren't headed off, that I think is another powerful way to kind of intervene in both the policy space and also the artistic space.
And it is interesting, especially how you start the story with the way that in this present time, which is fictionalized, but in this present time, we're refugee camps in Arizona and refugee old shopping malls that have turned into refugee spaces and waiting lists to get into poor housing, all leading into really the base of the story about how technology is taking advantage of it.
Yeah, and you know, this moment of bad technology is happening at the same time a bunch of other bad policies. You know, we're living in a moment where it's the concentration of wealth at the very top has become very extreme, as many people have observed. And when that happens, it becomes harder and harder to create policy if it gores some rich person's ox. You know, when the influence of rich people gets bigger, it's hard to do things that cut against their interests. And the richer the rich people get, the more oxes they own. And so the fewer policies we can act. And one good example of this is housing. And, you know, every major city in the world is going through a housing crisis as speculators buy and flip houses. And we're in this really weird moment where this thing that's an absolute human essential, you know, with no shelter, you have no life, has become an asset. And so governments are trying to increase the value of housing. Well, imagine if states decided to increase the value of other fundamentals, right? Imagine if bread became twice as expensive during a politician's tenure. We never vote for them again. But when you have a world where we're all precarious, where the only major asset we own and the thing that we're hedging against for our retirement is our home, where we're so leveraged in that house that if it doesn't continue to go up in value, yeah, we might end up underwater, you know, every politician is perversely incentivized to make our houses as expensive as possible.
And I would say that it also innately we will look the other way as citizens, even, because at the end it's going to benefit us.
That's right. Yeah, we're all co-opted into this system, because, you know, while we all acknowledge that we'd like our kids to be able to buy houses and that homelessness is a real problem and so on, we're also running up against the limits of our own precarity, where we're worried that if those policies were enacted, it might end up turning us into paupers. And so we're kind of sandwiched between it. And it, you know, one of the themes running through this book is the limits of individual action. We've had 40 years of this story about individual responsibility and individual consequences, and it only gets you so far. You know, I don't care how careful you are about your recycling, it's not going to fix climate change.
Cory Doctorow, my guest. The book is Radicalized. He's in Chicago. He's at C2E2, the big Comic-Con at the McCormick Place this weekend. He'll be talking and signing books at both on Saturday and Sunday. Cory Doctorow, my guest in the 8 o'clock hour tonight here on Extension 720. We'll take a break. Come back. Stay with us. Oh, that's great. Cory Doctorow in studio, Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Cory Doctorow's new book, Radicalized, which is a look at the future, but it's really a look at the present. It's four tales of our present moment. He's going to be at C2E2 this weekend, and he's in studio tonight. As we talk about technology and our future, last time you were here, it was for, I think it's for Runaway.
Walkaway,
I'm sorry. Walkaway, and we talked about, which is funny, because that's our whole premise tonight, walking away. But it was a lot about copyright and also just about, are we, like, the idea of surviving versus, I don't even know what the survivalist versus technology, and I'm sorry I'm not describing it quite right, but it's just interesting that you continue on this thread, you continue to push these stories and these storylines. When you talk about being a futurist writer, what are you looking to write about?
You know, I never want to write about the future. I only ever want to write parables about the present. I really feel like if they are ever going to chisel something on my tombstone, which they're not, because I'm going to leave my remains for med school pranks, but if they ever want to chisel something on my tombstone, I want it to be, this could all be so great if we don't screw it up. Because, you know, I grew up with computers. I was an 80s kid. My dad was a computer scientist. And I know that the promise of them, right? I know that this impetus to connect with other people is a noble one, to find people who have the same interests as you and you know, collaborate with them and have exciting new friendships and connections and communities. But I also know all the ways that computers can be hijacked to surveil us, to control us, to subvert our social relationships, to commodify them. And I don't think that opting out is an option. We live in a very technological society, and there's no going back. You know, if the technology fails, the mountain of bodies left behind will be sufficient to create so many pathogens that it will kill everyone that it doesn't kill.
That's right.
You know, I think that we have to figure out how to get it right. You know, Stuart Brand, the guy who started the Whole Earth Review and the Whole Earth Catalog and The Well and so many other things, Wired Magazine, he said, if we're going to be like gods, we might as well get good at it. And, you know, I think we are very bad gods at this moment, and figuring out how to use technology wisely, and part of that is writing fiction that is both about the promise and the peril of technology. That's a really important mission that we're on right now.
We talked about Unauthorized Breads, and there's three other stories, we'll get to them. But the you know, one of the issues in that story has to do with the concept that the way around the way technology is subverting us or keeping us down or controlling us is humanity, is this idea, the jailbreak, the way that humans are going to find a way to persevere and get around technology. How does that play out in real life?
Well, you know, I think that, that we're long past the moment at which people would try to find a path from A to Z, you know, where it's like, well, I know where I want to get to, and I know exactly how I'm going to get there in terms of my theory of change. And we now acknowledge that we're in this complex terrain that we could never traverse easily, that we can never plot a course across. And instead, what we try to do is have like a rule of thumb, like, how do I know if I'm going in the right direction? And for me, that's the difference between a kind of fatalistic optimism, where things will just get better and I don't need to participate in them, and hope. Hope is the idea that if you strive hard enough, and if there are people around you striving with you, that you may be able to make a difference. And so you have people, for example, who write code, and that code opens up new technological possibilities. You have people who do things in the market. They start businesses or support businesses, and those open up new possibilities and create new stakeholders. You have people who advocate for laws. And you have people who have normative conversations, like this one we're having, mm-hmm. who advocate for better ways of thinking about things. You know, there was a time when, in the early days of STEM education, where it was a form of self-defense, right? There was activists who started STEM education. They said, you have to program or be programmed. If you don't teach people how to be masters of their technologies will be masters of them. And that's been co-opted into this idea that if you don't get your kids a STEM education, they won't get a good job. Well, you know, a STEM education can help you get a good job, but what a STEM education can really do is help you seize the means of information and ensure that the technology that was designed to force you to arrange your affairs to benefit the firm mm-hmm. that made it can be rearranged so that it benefits you first.
To understand the life you're living.
Yeah, yeah, and to understand that the things that seem like vast impersonal forces are in fact choices that someone made. You know, people talk about Google and privacy and surveillance capitalism. No one came down off a mountain with 2 stone tablets that said, thou shalt stop rotating thine log files and instead mine them for actionable market intelligence. Someone made a choice, right? To store that data, to mine it, and ultimately, as we keep seeing, to leak it and leak it and leak it and destroy life after life after life. And all those people who say, well, it's unfortunate that we leaked the data, but who could have foreseen it? Those people need to be held to account someday, because honestly, anyone could have foreseen it.
Cory Doctorow is my guest. He's at C2E2 tomorrow, signing books and speaking to the crowd. Radicalized is a new book. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's headlines, and we'll continue our conversation with Cory Doctorow here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Back to Justin Kaufman and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight, Cory Doctorow, the great author, his new book, Radicalized. You were here before with Walk Away. You're going to be at C2E2 this weekend. You're the co-editor at Boing Boing. You are our tech savior in the way that you're starting conversations. And I guess as we pick up where we left off, you talk about a need for us to have these conversations, that more often than not, there any sort of stories that have to do with our digital world or technology or corporatizing of that technology just gets glossed over, or it's too hard for people to understand, so they just don't want to be involved in it. But you have been at Boing Boing and with your fiction work, but also just as a policy, I don't want to call you a wonk, but policy guy.
Activist.
You've dedicated your life to trying to have this conversation. Are people listening?
Yeah, you know, here's what I think has happened. I think that we've had really bad tech policy, not because tech is too complicated to understand. I mean, like, epidemiology and microbiology are hard to understand, but we're not all dead of listeria, even though we don't have a lot of biologists in Congress, right?
Right.
The way that we ended up not dead of listeria is we had a process by which you had experts and you had expert agencies, and the regulators regulated the firms, and they kind of tried to find evidence and measure outcomes and so on. And and any other kind of technology is not so different. What's changed is that it's become very hard to have evidence-based policy. And it's been hard to get people to care about it because the policy debt doesn't come due for a long time, right? We've had an inkling about climate change for a long time, 25, 30 years. But because the cause and the effect are separated by so much time and space, it's very hard to definitively convince people, especially people who don't want to be convinced, especially people who are in a world where someone's spending a lot of money to keep them from being convinced that there's something going on here that they need to pay attention to. And so you end up with this thing where the job of an activist for the first 20 years is convincing people that there's a problem. But then you reach what I call the point of peak indifference, where the problem, because it's real, eventually just reaches a breaking point where people's lives are being ruined on the regular by the problem. And you see this with climate, you see this privacy and data breaches, you see this with all kinds of policies that we've not had evidence-based policy on. And then people start to realize that there's a problem, but then they start to think, well, maybe it's too late to do anything about it. Yeah. So the job switches from convincing people that there's a problem to convincing people that something can be done. You know, if I spend 20 years trying to convince you that you need to care about rhino populations, and then by the time you care, there's only one rhino left, it's really tempting to say, you know, might as well find out what he tastes like, right? And so we really need to kind of head off that nihilism. And that's a thing that fiction is really good at. It's really good at telling stories that show you what the shape of resistance looks like. It may not be like a specific roadmap. We're never going to be, you know, Dumbledore's army. We're never going to be the resistance. We're never going to be the rebellion. But it shows you the shape of what that looks like, what that solidarity looks like, what that pushing back looks like.
Are you getting people's attention more through your work of fiction than you are through your policy activism?
I think that they're really complementary. You know, I've been fighting about this European copyright
director,
which is this long story we could talk all night about, but it's, you know, TLDR, it's this idea in Europe that's being voted on late Monday night, Tuesday morning their time, that if it passes would be the end of the internet as we understand it and would give us an age in which the internet was just cable TV forever. And you know, there's been a lot of policy fights about it.
So we're talking censorship or...
It's basically everyone's got to have copyright filters. So everything you say and do on the internet is going to have to be sucked into a copyright filter. Check to see whether the filter thinks that it's a copyright infringement and block it if it thinks that it is. And copyright infringement in this case means, does it match a thing in a database that anyone can add anything to? I could put the whole works of Shakespeare in there. No one could quote Shakespeare until someone went in and took it out.
Oh my gosh, it's your book. It's exactly what you're writing about.
Yeah, idea.
Right.
But, you know, I wrote a short story about this being used against people who discover a Chinese trawler violating a fishery agreement and fishing with long nets. And they have drones and they do a super high-tech operation. They get the footage, they get the evidence, they use sonar and radar to capture the net and so on. And they upload it to the internet and they're trending, and then all of a sudden it all disappears because the fishing company has uploaded their videos to the copyright filters and made it disappear. And that got much more of a spread than all these dry policy fights. Mm-hmm. But what that did was it directed people to the dry policy stuff so that they could take place. And now on tomorrow, we're planning for the largest European street demonstrations in recent memory. We've got 5 million signatures on a petition, more signatures than any petition in world history, right? So we're like, we may win, you know?
It's a sad story, and it's one that I think there's a lot of, we go into the political aspects of this and what we expect from our government and what we expect from the free market. And that's mm-hmm. been an argument that's been had between the right and left in the world over time. But it also just feels that people are figuring out, mostly in the corporate level, how to weaponize tech and to use it for their gain. And as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, this idea that it's to keep people enslaved or to keep people in line or in control. And that almost is antithetical to how the internet was even built.
Well, and it's funny because that's the thing that actually markets are pretty good at, right? Like if I sold you a fridge where the butter dish was an add-on and it came with a special bolt with a screw that you had to unscrew and, you know, you had to give me $10 for the screwdriver to unscrew it, someone would sell you the screwdriver for 99 cents. The thing is that as markets have concentrated and firms have gotten bigger, so we've got five big internet firms, five big movie studios that became four this week, four big record labels, five big publishers that are about to become four because it looks like Simon & Schuster is going to end up part of HarperCollins. As these industries have concentrated, they've been able to call the shots more and more. And so now, you know, in a technological sense, when John Deere puts a lock on its tractors that stops farmers from accessing their own field data about their soil conditions that's generated by driving their own tractors around their own fields, that has the force of law behind it. You know, thanks to a Clinton-era law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's a potential felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence to provide a farmer with a tool that lets them break open their tractor and access that data.
It makes me think about you're right. The market seems to be correcting itself in the way that they will say,
could correct itself. Yeah, sure.
But I think a lot of people are ineffectual or may not be interested in this or like you said, haven't really found their breaking point yet because they expect the government to protect them.
Which, you know, it's not a crazy idea to think that, like, well, you know, when I fill up my glass from the tap, I don't bring along my assay kit to figure out how much lead there is in the water, right? We live in a complex technological society, and we can't all be experts on all of the subjects that need to be handled correctly in order for us to navigate the world. And so you need to believe that your 737 Boeing MAX was safe and not designed, as it seems, with the safety features as an extra that you have to pay as an upgrade as an airline.
That's a real story.
That is a real story. You know, we don't know exactly what caused those planes to fail, but we do know that Boeing had a thing that helped pilots resolve conflicts between two key sensors, and that wasn't sold standard. It was an add-on. And that we know that the airlines in poorer countries didn't buy the add-on.
But regardless, and no one is saying that that's what caused those airlines to crash. But what it tells you is that this idea of what we're talking about technology and how it becomes corporatized, that they're finding ways when it comes to even airplane safety to say, well, here's a way we can make money off of that.
Well, and you know, again, like you would expect that in a fair society, on the one hand, you'd have regulators who'd smack them around when they did this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, you'd expect that you'd have companies that would enter the market to correct it. But, you know, they call anything that the big five tech companies are doing, the venture capitalists call it the kill zone. So you can't get funded to start a search engine today, or a social media network, or a competitor to Apple. You know, those markets are unassailable because they've got them sewn up. You know, when you hear people like Elizabeth Warren talking about breaking up big tech, what they're really talking about is reestablishing markets.
Hmm. You know, let's talk about politics real quick. We saw a lot with the Green New Deal, and this was something that came out not too long ago, Really, you heard from the sponsors of the bill, or the idea, or the letter, the summary, whatever you want to call it, that this was a starting off point. This is the conversation, like you mentioned.
Right.
We need to have more of these conversations. But the conversation quickly became partisan, and it's something that became hype around the personalities, the cult of personality, whoever wrote it, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
But if you really look at the form, what they were doing, they were talking about a new Bill of Rights. You mentioned housing earlier. In the Green New Deal, they talk about affordable housing as a right. That we need to set the new rules in which we live and abide by as human beings on this planet.
Yeah.
That is a noble thing for our politicians to be talking, is it not?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that we can talk about this in all kinds of ways. So we can talk about the fact that, like, it's a good deal to have people in your city not living on the streets, right? It's a good deal because it's cheaper than the cost of homelessness in terms of policing and emergency services and the spread of tuberculosis. And speaking as someone who used to live in the Mission District of San Francisco, human feces on your sidewalk, no fun, and all of those other things, plus the grinding, soul-numbing misery of stepping over unconscious people on your way home and on your way back. And all of those things make it a good deal. But let's set all that aside and just say that if your empathy is so hobbled that you don't understand that the people who live in the same city as you deserve to have a roof over their heads, especially people who are working hard, but even people who are struggling, then we have a problem, because we have, again, a shared destiny. And most of us are in precarious circumstances. And in fact, ironically, I think it's that precariousness that makes us say, well, how can I afford to give to you when I'm not sure where I'm going to end up? But the answer is, if you're not sure where you're going to end up, then you should be really concerned about the net. And right now, we're living without a net.
It's an interesting thought. And it's not just housing, because you look at climate change, you can say we have the right to clean air. We have the right to clean water. These are not rights that are in the Bill of Rights that our forefathers decided.
Although
to put
life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is hard when you're dying of lead poisoning.
That's true. But it seems to me that these are the conversations we should be having. Instead, we almost look to WGN, to CNN, to Fox News, to whatever, to dictate the conversation. If you look at all the stuff right now, it's about a Mueller report.
Right
now, they're talking right now about what could possibly be in it. We know what's in it.
Right. Well, maybe we know. I mean, I think our political consensus is really far away from the actual consensus of the people. You know, if you think about something like, say, net neutrality, it's kind of a no-brainer, right? It's the idea that, like, if you have an internet connection, the people who sell it to you should get you the internet resources that you ask for. for and not the ones that make them the most money, right? 87% of Americans support that policy, which is pretty crazy when you think that, like, this is the intersection of competition policy and telecoms. Like, that is not so much a Venn diagram as it is a sphincter, and yet 87% right. of Americans 87%. Are, like, hardcore for net neutrality. Same with universal healthcare. Same with, you know, sensible controls on guns, and so on and so on. The Washington consensus and the, you know, kind of establishment media consensus is really far away from the actual political consensus in the country. And, you know, we talk about the country being polarized. It's not really polarized. You have a giant middle that wants something that a tiny minority of people don't. That's not polarization. That's just like anti-majoritarianism in action, right? Where it's the tyranny of the minority.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe we'll show up in... It's funny to think about the themes and the things that we're talking about are things that are in both of all the books that you've put together, yeah. including Radicalized.
Well, you know, the last story in this book, The Mask of the Red Death, is about the limits of individual action in crisis. It's about a rich prepper in Arizona. He's got this bunker. He's ready for the end times. He's going to go and hide out with his friends who are all crack shots. And he's got, you know, thumb drives full of Bitcoin and gemstone quality stones and lots of bullion and all the MREs you can eat. And he's just going to hunker down while the lesser people eliminate each other, and then he'll emerge into and, you know, kind of reenact a Frazetta painting and become, like, you know, a warlord with a harem or something. And what he fails to recognize is that the real heroes of a disaster are not the ones who run away, they're the ones who run too, right? They're the ones who get the sanitation running again. Yeah. The people who run away are the ones who die of cholera.
You know, we'll wrap up here, but in South by, you were just at South by Southwest, and yeah. You did a panel, and it was interesting because it was about the perception of AI mm-hmm. from a Hollywood standpoint versus mm-hmm. reality. Those mm-hmm. storylines from movies like Terminator,
yeah, sure.
or you know, HAL, or I'm thinking of others, like even The Matrix to a certain
yeah,
extent.
Sure.
But this concept that Hollywood has hijacked AI and what artificial intelligence really means. And, you know, what did you learn from that panel?
The thing that always strikes me when we talk about machine learning is that if we call machine learning by the name that we called it until a few years ago, which is statistics, instead of data science and artificial intelligence, it would be a lot easier to unpick. You know, look at Chicago and other cities that have bought predictive policing services from so-called machine learning or AI companies. What they're doing is they're saying, well, our police are racist. They operated an off-the-books black site full of torture. They engaged in stop and frisk. We need to have an algorithm objectively tell them where the crime is going to be. So we're going to ask it to analyze where the crime was and then from that predict where the crime is going to be. Except you're not asking it to predict where the crime, look at where the crime was. You're asking it to look at where the arrests were. And your starting premise is that the arrests were racially biased. And so, you know, it's like going into a classroom full of third graders and measuring them all and then doing a statistical analysis and then making a prediction about how tall some arbitrary stranger is. You're like, I bet that stranger is 4'2", right? You know, In the days when we called this stuff statistics, we had a motto, garbage in, garbage out. Right now that we call it machine learning, we're like, it is inscrutable, it can't be interrogated,
right.
We can't know what it means, we just have to do what the machine says. You know, there may be better methods for making the computer science work, but the way that we're doing now it is the worst method. You know, we have companies that are mining data in opaque ways that don't show what their data is, that don't tell you how they do it, that don't expose their results to public scrutiny, that bind the cities that sign contracts to them to non-disparagement and non-disclosure clauses so they can't tell you what's wrong, nor can they complain about it. You know, I don't know exactly how you make a good system, but I know how you make a bad one. That's how you make a bad system.
Cory Doctorow, always a pleasure, man. Always great to have
Absolutely
you here.
My pleasure
the new book is Radicalized, which is out now, and you can see him at C2E2 tomorrow and Sunday, the great Comic-Con, which is at the McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Cory, thanks again, man.
Thank you.